It's time for Outdoors with Luke Clayton on your station, 88.9 KETR.
Hello, folks. It's your old buddy Luke Clayton. It is once again time for us to enjoy the next 15 minutes here on KETR and talk about the outdoors. Today's show is made possible by the Dallas Safari Club. The website for the Dallas Safari Club is biggame.org. And today's show is also made possible by Brute Outdoors, home of the Brute Box Coolers. The website there is bruteoutdoors.com. The phone number is 855-BRUTE-55. You know, there has been a lot going on in the outdoors. This past week down in Austin, a committee met with a group of folks that are involved in the deer breeding business, you know, high-fenced operations and ranches that produce some of the awesome heavy-antlered bucks that are harvested in Texas every year. It's a lot of controversy in this. There's a rule now that pen-raised deer have to be released 10 days before they're hunted, and the talk is that there's a group that would like to see this increased to 30 to 60 days in upcoming years, gradually increased to where the deer that are raised, the bucks that are raised to sold to hunting ranches or other ranches, when they're sold, they have to be released a longer period than the 10 days, which is currently the law. So there's a lot of ramifications moving deer in the summertime when their antlers are in velvet. A good buddy of mine, Mike Ford, that owns the Rio Rojo Rancho up in Red River County. Mike's a deer breeder and also has a hunting ranch up there. And Mike pointed out to me, you know, if you start moving the deer in the middle of the summer, there's going to be a lot of loss. Those deer are in velvet. You know, they're not yet in hard horn in June and July, and it's a good chance to lose a lot of the deer. So it's really a controversial issue. But the fact is that deer breeders now are producing some awesome big bucks, and ranches are buying these bucks and introducing them into the gene pool of their existing deer herd. So I know there's a lot more going to be heard about this in upcoming months and years, and it'll be very interesting to see how it all shakes out. I just hope deer hunting goes on for eons. It's such a great sport, and hunting deer in the Lone Star State here is just a tradition. I've had a chance as an old outdoors writer to hunt deer all over the country, but there's something really special about hunting them here at home in the Lone Star State. You know, fishing this week ought to be really picking up with the warmer weather. Last week was a pretty cold. We had some cold nights, and my crappie contacts with Billy Kilpatrick up on Levon and Seth Vanover up at Lake Fork that guide for crappie, you know, they were waiting for this warming trend. So I'm going to predict, and this is based on me fishing for crappie a lot through the years and what these pro guides are telling me, this week ought to be a good week for crappie to make the mass exodus from deep water to shallow. And when they do, that's when 90% of the fish are truly in 10% of the water. So let's watch this weather, watch these temperatures. If the water temperature continues to rise just a degree or two the rest of this week, next week ought to be gangbusters for catching shallow water crappie. We need some 75, 80 degree days, afternoons is what we need, and some nights that don't get really cold to push those crappie shallow. Down at Lake Fork and any lake that's holding a healthy population of largemouth bass, the spawn is on. It's actually been on. But right now those bass are locked down on shallow structure, on beds. Water as shallow as a foot deep, up to 3 foot. But, you know, we've had Larry Large on with us many times in the past, and Larry's always given a tip on catching shallow water bass when they're spawning. So many people, especially at Lake Fork, get right up on the bank and they just hammer. They pull their boat up within 10, 15 feet of the bank and just hammer the fish that they can see using polarized glasses. You can easily see the beds, you know, the nest that the bass make. Well, Larry is a big proponent of getting out maybe 50 feet, 60 feet from the bank and fishing for bass that you can't see. Those bass are going to be a whole lot less spooky than fish that are right up shallow, you know, in that real shallow water. So it's a good tip, and it's just a lot more pleasant fishing, and you're not in crowded waters if you can back out there 30, 40 yards and cast up toward the bank and work that structure that you can't see. A bait that I've learned to fish with in the last 3 or 4 years is an unweighted fluke. These baits are, you get nicknamed a do-nothing bait, but basically it's just a soft plastic. It might be 4 or 6 inches long. You can rig it Texas style, or you can rig it wacky style, hook it right through the middle But Texas style is probably the most popular way. Just throw that up in the shallows and allow it to sink really slowly. And you'll see that line twitch when that old bass hits it, and be ready to, you know, kind of keep your line loaded up, not really, really tight, but where you can feel that bite. And when you see your line twitch, jerk back and set the hook. But fishing with unweighted soft plastics has become really, really popular in the last 5 or 6 years. And it is a good way to catch bass. You know, the white bass, the sand bass, most of them are back from their spawn. And say take up at Lake Tawakoni, for instance, you know, around the Greenville pump station up on the north side of the lake, that's always one of the first spots. There's some deep ridges right out from the Greenville pump station there that the post-spawn white bass like to stack up on, but they're catching them there now, and then they're already moving on down to the lake. So not just Tawakoni, Richland Chambers, Levon, all the lakes with a healthy population of white bass, sand bass, now's a good time to catch them. I'm always amazed that in January and February, everybody's hot to trot for the annual white bass run, and more often than not, that white bass run is just a trickle. You know, it's a hit or miss thing when you get up in the creeks and the streams and the rivers above the lakes. The water clarity has to be just right. There has to be a little bit of current to keep the water moving, keep those eggs moving when they're laid. There's a lot of things that have to come together for a successful white bass trip during the spawn. But right now, you can take a little half ounce, three quarter ounce jig and spoon, a lead slab, chartreuse, silver, white. I don't think the color matters really all that much once you get on some fish holding on structure. And a lot of times they are really tight to structure this time of year. They'll be 2 or 3 feet off the bottom. That's the way when I fished with guides all my life doing articles for magazines and newspapers, I loved a slab fish, vertical jig with a slab. And I always ask them, how do the fish like it now? Because sometimes, like in the really, really cold water, when water's down in the 40s, you can still catch them if you downsize your slab, but you need to lay that thing down on the bottom and just barely, barely move it. I've had a guy down at Richland Chambers once tell me, Luke, here's what you want to do. In your mind, think that you're standing that slab on its tail down on the mud and laying it over on either side. Well, in truth, with the wave action and the wind and the boat moving, that slab is probably moving 3 or 4 feet, or maybe not quite that much, but it's moving a bunch. You're not just holding it stationary. But the trick is to put very little movement into it when the water's cold. But right now, the water's warming up, so I think it's a good idea to start bouncing the slab on bottom. Use your sonar and find a hump or ridge that's holding some bait and some sand bass. Start off near the bottom, and if you don't get bit with a slow bait presentation, well, then start lifting it up and letting it flutter back down. Most of these slabs are built to flutter back down. They don't just drop like a lead ball, but they'll flutter. A lot of times that fluttering action is what triggers the strike. You know, a while back we had Don Gresham on our show. Don with Going Trapping. Don is the one that sets up the traps and monitors the traps. And for the past 3 years, he studied not only the traps that are on his ranch, but the traps from Mississippi all the way to Texas. And if you remember, if you listen to that show, Don said usually when hogs are moving in Mississippi or Texas or Louisiana, they're moving all over. And the moon phase is what is key. And, you know, I've hunted hogs and trapped them amateurishly a lot through the years for fun and meat mostly. But I've never really paid that much attention to the moon. But Don tells me, beyond any shadow of a doubt, the first and last quarters of the moon phase is when 75% of the hog movement takes place. Now, I live 1 mile from some excellent hog hunting. There's a wetlands close to where I live. There's a river. There's a slough that runs through the land that I've got leased. I've had this lease for 10 or 12 years, something like that. And I watch hogs a lot. I keep trail cameras out, and I'm in the woods almost every day for an hour or so. It's pretty good exercise. I usually get up in the morning, and I've got about 5 or 6 feeders that I keep going, and I have about 4 trail cameras, so I'm always watching where the hogs are moving. Something that I thought was really strange is about 3 weeks ago, I stopped seeing sows. Now, I would see sounders. That's what you call a group of wild hogs, but I would see sounders of 5 or 6 sows. There'd be some young boars, maybe a big boar off to the side on my trail cameras. And when I was hunting, that's what I was seeing. About 3 or 4 weeks ago, the sows stopped coming. I haven't seen a sow until last night. I monitored the cameras early this morning, and they started showing back up. They've got pigs that are not newborn. These pigs are probably a month old. So I talked to Don Gresham with Going Fencing that monitors all these traps and all these cameras. He told me the same phenomenon was going on his ranch and other ranches. There's no real answer. Maybe the hogs are feeding on ryegrass. You know, there's a lot of wild ryegrass out there now. There's bound to be a food source where those sows are feeding on with the pigs. But the good news is they're back, and it's about time to put some more pork chops in the freezer. So old Luke's going to be spending some time, maybe losing a little bit of sleep, but I'm going to have those night lights going here in a couple of evenings, probably this Friday evening, and see if I can put some more pork in the freezer. You know, today's show, I wanted to just visit with everyone and kind of scattergun, talk about a whole lot of varied subjects. But I have a new recipe, or it's new to me. Probably many of you have tried it, but I love camp cooking. I love to cook with Dutch kettles. I've recently learned a new recipe that I want to relate to you. It's called 7-Up Biscuits, and I use my Dutch kettles to do it. Now, if you want to cook these in the oven in the house, the 450 oven will do it. But I like to use my number 10 Dutch kettle. You know, a Dutch kettle always has a recessed top, and it either has legs or bricks that you can put bricks under if it has a flat bottom to elevate it up off the ground so you can get coals under it. You need coals under it, and you need coals on top to bake in a Dutch kettle. Well, this is a real simple recipe. All that you need is 2 cups of Bisquick, a half a cup of sour cream, 1/2 cup 7-Up, and 1/4 cup of butter. Now, cooking it in a Dutch kettle, I'll tell you how I do it, and if you want to cook it in the oven in your house, you can do that. It's the same principle. I take the butter, the quarter cup of butter, and melt it. Put it in the bottom of the Dutch kettle. Now, you want to put your 2 cups of Bisquick in a big bowl, and you want to cut in the 1/2 cup of sour cream. And just do that with your hands. Knead it. You want your dough will get pretty tacky, pretty sticky, if you don't add some more Bisquick in there with it. But, you know, work it a little bit, add some more Bisquick, and then you'll be able to really knead the dough. So after the sour cream is incorporated into your Bisquick, go ahead and add your 7-Up, your 1/2 cup of 7-Up. When you pour it in there, you're going to think, uh-oh, I've got it way too wet. But put a little more Bisquick in there and keep kneading, working that 7-Up into the mixture, and it won't take very long. It'll be the right consistency, and then simply roll it out like you're going to make biscuits. I don't drop the dough. I like to cut the biscuits with a biscuit cutter or just the top of a cup or glass. Just make your biscuits out of the raw dough, put them in the bottom of that cast iron pot, and if you want to cook them in the oven, you can, you know, you definitely would not want a lid on them if you're using them in the oven. But if you're cooking with a Dutch kettle, you've got to have your lid. But place them all down in there. They'll all kind of get together when they start cooking. I put about, if I'm using a number 10 Dutch kettle, I'll put 13 charcoal briquettes. This is a good barometer for you. 13 briquettes on top and then 7 below. You want to use 3 more than the size of the Dutch kettle. Number 10, that'll be 13 on the top, 7 below. And about 12 to 15 minutes, I'll take, when I'm cooking them outdoors on the coals, I'll take some vice grips or heavy gloves and just open them up. You don't want them to burn. But about 12 minutes, 13 minutes, it's time to check them. You might want to put your lid back on and let them cook another 4 or 5 minutes. But by 15 minutes, they'll be ready to go. And I'll guarantee you, these 7-Up biscuits are great whether you're eating them at camp or if you're cooking them at home for a special breakfast. Folks, we are out of time. I've enjoyed visiting with you today. Do remember that this show is made possible by the Dallas Safari Club. That website is biggame.org. And it's also made possible by Brute Outdoors, home of the Brute Box Cooler. Now, that website is bruteoutdoors.com. The phone number is 855-BRUTE-55. Remember, you can listen to the archive of this show and past shows at ketr.org. And make sure and tune in next week. We'll have some more fun talking outdoors.
Luke Clayton has been addicted to everything outdoors since his childhood. He grew up hunting and fishing in rural Northeast Texas. Luke pens a weekly newspaper column that appears in over 50 newspapers. For videos, archived newspaper articles, and more information, visit catfishradio.com. This has been Outdoors with Luke Clayton on your station, 88.9 KETR.